Studies. She has been a member and recently the president-elect of the Society for Old Testament Study. Her works exhibit exhaustive readings of both primary and secondary sources, thinking that it is both rigorous and imaginative, and impressive mastery of these materials at both the macro and micro scales. She demonstrates bold vision in suggesting hypotheses, and she displays an uncanny ability to trace thematic connections between texts. I get a sense of immense learning and a continuing progression, with each book growing from and building on the foundation of earlier ones. In her work, she strives to illuminate the origins of Christianity. In that effort, she focuses on the relation of the mythos of the First Temple to the self-understanding of Jesus and the earliest Christians. Beyond this, she writes not as a dispassionate scholar, but one deeply involved and committed, not just to understanding, but to living Christianity and persuading others to commitment and action. She expresses concern that scholarship is often viewed with suspicion and felt to be destructive and irrelevant. The concerns of scholars are seen as remote from those who actually use and read the Bible. She says, "The building of bridges between scholarship and Christian teaching is one that has concerned me for many years. If the present gulf continues, the results could be disastrous. We shall have churches divorced from specialized knowledge of Christian tradition, and scholars with no pictures in which the ideas of the Bible are expressed are specific to one culture, that of Israel and Judaism, and until they are fully understood in their original setting, little of what is done with the writings and ideas from that period can be understood. Once we lose touch with the meaning of biblical imagery, we lose any way into the real meaning of the Bible. It is folly to approach the Bible with a 20th century mind, completely unaware of the codes in which it was written. Such a reading of the scriptures does nothing to build up the faith of the churches. Rather, it leads to a trivialization of the scriptures and then confusion." And this agrees, of course, with 2 Nephi 25, verses 1 through 5, which concludes, "There is none other people that understand the things which were spoken unto the Jews like unto them, save it be that they are taught after the manner of the things of the Jews." Barker's picture of the Old Testament. In her books, Margaret Barker builds a strong argument that the cultural key to unlocking the New Testament comes from the world of the First Temple. The subtitle of her first book, The Old Testament, is The Survival of Themes from an Ancient Royal Cult in Sectarian Judaism and Early Christianity. She claims this background was largely suppressed from the Old Testament as we have it and from first century Judaism as had been understood before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and other early writings such as 1 Enoch. But while the old temple traditions were largely suppressed in the canon and obscured further by modern translations, she argues that the temple traditions were known and understood by contemporaries of Jesus and provided the mythos in which he was known and in which he came to know himself. There's a quote. "There were many in first century Palestine who still retained a worldview derived from the more ancient religion of Israel, that of the first temple, in which there was a high God and several sons of God, one of whom was Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. Yahweh could be manifest on earth in human form as an angel or in the Davidic king. It was as a manifestation of Yahweh, the Son of God, that Jesus was acknowledged as Son of God, Messiah, and Lord." Her books explore the evidence and implications of this temple background for understanding the New Testament and the origins of Christianity. The life and works in Jesus were and should be interpreted in light of something other than Jerusalem Judaism. This other had its roots in the conflicts of the 6th century BC, when the traditions of the monarchy were divided as an inheritance among several heirs. It would have been lost but for the accidents of archaeological discovery and the evidence preserved and transmitted only by Christian hands. That reference to Jerusalem and the 6th century BC as the crucial time and place should attract our attention. That brings the Book of Mormon into the arena. In the Old Testament, she asks, was there more, far more, in the religion of pre-exilic Jerusalem than later writers wished to perpetuate? Critics of the Book of Mormon sometimes claim that it contains concepts that are out of place in pre-exilic Israel. Barker's work challenges us to do two things. First, we need to better understand the conflicts in Jerusalem before the exile, particularly as they relate to the composition and transmission of sacred writings around that time. Second, we need to compare her picture of these other suppressed traditions with what we have in the Book of Mormon, which reports itself as being rooted in this crucial period. So, Josiah and the Deuteronomists. One key event for the conflicts in Jerusalem before the exile was the discovery of the Book of the Law during a renovation of the Jerusalem Temple during the reign of King Josiah. Lehi would be contemporary with these events. In our Bible, 2 Kings 22 and 2 Chronicles 34 give slightly differing accounts of the discovery of the book of the law and the partially violent 10-year reform that Josiah launched in response to that discovery. Most scholars believe that the book of the law that was discovered included at least part of Deuteronomy. Hence, Josiah's reform has been associated with the book of Deuteronomy. On the other hand, Barker observes that only the Deuteronomic version of the story, that in 2 Kings, invites the association of Josiah's reform with Deuteronomy. The Chronicles account has the document discovered after the reform was underway. Still, the distinctive values associated with the book of Deuteronomy also characterize the books of Joshua, Samuel, and Kings to the extent that they are called the Deuteronomist history. These show evidence of having a first edition produced during Josiah's reign, specifically to celebrate King Josiah. The first edition ended with the verse in 2 Kings 23:25 that says of Josiah, "There was no king before him that turned to the Lord with all his heart and with all his soul and with all his might, according to the law of Moses." Later Deuteronomist editors provided editing and additions to the original text after Josiah's unexpected death and the subsequent events leading to the fall of Jerusalem during the reign of Zedekiah to the start of the Babylonian captivity. The Deuteronomist influence left a distinctive imprint on much of the Bible, and indeed the conspicuous use of the Exodus theme in the Book of Mormon, the emphasis on Moses, and on blessings and cursings depending on Israel's obedience are all consistent with their program. It is of note, but not the topic of this paper, that the Book of Mormon takes pains not to oversimplify the experience of suffering, misfortune, and evil in striking contrast to the Deuteronomist tone of Job's comforters. That's something I'm going to do on a later rev on this paper. John Welch of BYU recently suggested that the brass plates that Nephi acquired would plausibly fit as a royal set commissioned during Josiah's reform. The discovery of a significant lost writing would certainly raise awareness of the need to recover, read, and preserve the sacred records. It is noteworthy that the 6th century Middle East is associated with the rise of interest in writing on metal plates. Also, the oldest known biblical text, a priestly blessing from Numbers 6:24-26, written on a rolled-up strip of silver, actually comes from Jerusalem and dates around 600 BC. Richard Elliott Friedman's book, Who Wrote the Bible? A popular explanation of the documentary hypothesis, presents arguments that the first edition of the Deuteronomist history was produced during Josiah's lifetime, and that most of the sources of the current Pentateuch existed while Jeremiah prophesied Jerusalem. Jeremiah wrote a lamentation for Josiah and witnessed the failure of Josiah's reform. Recall that Jeremiah's writings preserve evidence of his conflicts with different groups of priests and scribes over sacred writings and with the populace over religious practices. Remember, too, that although there were versions of scriptural books in existence before the fall of Jerusalem, the final selection and editing of the canon as we have it in our Bibles took place after the return from the exile. Barker credits the suppression of many significant ideas to the Deuteronomist school. I've got a book about them by another writer, a Catholic writer named Duorley, called Obsession with Justice, that pretty much summarizes one of their main themes. The notion of blessings for obedience and cursings for disobedience is a keynote. It also provides the fodder for the crisis they faced after the death of Josiah, their perfect king. Why wasn't he blessed? It also provides more fodder for the crisis facing the exiles. Given that possession of the promised land was conditioned on obedience, what claim did the exiles have on the land as they returned from Babylon? Think of the Deuteronomists as providing successive waves of composition and editorial influence on the scriptures. Their effort involves variations on a theme, reacting to changing situations. We should not imagine a single period of activity based on a static program. The first wave came with Josiah's decade of reform, the composition of the Deuteronomist history, and the re-emphasis on Moses and Israelite religion. This reform effort was interrupted by Josiah's death. 2 Kings 24, 35-37 records that Josiah's successor, Jehoiakim, reigned 11 years and did that which is evil in the sight of the Lord. After Jehoiakim, we have Zedekiah reigning for 11 years, another king who the Deuteronomist depicts as doing evil in the sight of the Lord, as Jehoiakim had done. So we have secondary waves of Deuteronomist editing and composition to record the death of Josiah and to describe and interpret the situation in Jerusalem and into the exile. Their work attempts to both assert their values and to reconcile those values with the crises caused by the death of Josiah, the fall of Jerusalem, and the destruction of the temple and the monarchy. It is very clear that much of the editorial program associated with the Deuteronomist school occurred after Lehi's group left. Furthermore, the final editors of the Old Testament came after the return, probably at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah and the Chronicler. They had a rather different agenda than the Deuteronomists, but many of the writings that the succeeding groups had to work with had already passed through their hands. And regarding the dominant interpretations of the Bible, Barker adds this comment. The reforming Deuteronomists, with their emphasis on history and law, have invoked a sympathetic response in many scholars who have found there a religion after their own heart. Thus, we have inherited a double distortion. The reformers edited much of what we read in the Hebrew Bible, and the modern interpreters with a similar cast of mind have told us that what the whole of that Hebrew Bible was saying. The fact that most ancient readers read the text very differently is seen as a puzzle. So, now, we're getting to the meat of this. Barker's pre-exilic Judaism and the Book of Mormon. With that background, let's look at what the Deuteronomists suppressed. Barker cites the preface to Deuteronomy, now chapter 4 of our Bibles, in Deuteronomy, as showing what this group set out to remove from the religion of Israel. First, they were to have the law instead of wisdom, Deuteronomy 4:6. What was the wisdom that the law replaced? Second, they were to think only of the formless voice of God sounding from the fire and giving the law, Deuteronomy 4:12. Israel had long had a belief in the vision of God when the glory had been visible on the throne in human form, surrounded by the heavenly hosts. What happened to the visions of God? And third, they were to leave the veneration of the host of heaven to peoples not chosen by Yahweh, Deuteronomy 4:19-20. Israel had long regarded Yahweh as the Lord of the hosts of heaven, but the title Yahweh of hosts was not used by the Deuteronomists. What happened to the hosts, the angels? Barker observes that the Deuteronomist theology, at least the exilic school, was strictly monotheistic. The Deuteronomists were fervent monotheists, which has led us to believe that all the Old Testament describes a strictly monotheistic religion. They also said that God could not be seen, only heard. There were, however, ancient traditions which said otherwise in each case. There was, as we shall see, a belief in a second divine being who could have human form, and this became the basis of Christianity. Notice that she says the title Lord of Hosts does not appear in their writings. So, an additional point of interest in the Book of Mormon is that the title Lord of Hosts appears over 50 times. Also, that God in the Book of Mormon takes human form. So, the reform of Josiah, the Deuteronomist then, constructed as best we can from both biblical and non-biblical sources, seems to have been a time when more than pagan accretions were removed from the Jerusalem cult. Wisdom was eliminated, even though her presence was never forgotten. The heavenly ascent and the vision of God were abandoned. The hosts of heaven, the angels, were declared unfit for the chosen people, and the ark, the presence of Yahweh which it represented, was removed. And the role of the high priest was altered in that he was no longer the anointed. All of these features of the older cult were to appear in Christianity. These features of the older cult are also conspicuous in the Book of Mormon. But first, which older cult is she talking about? Recall that the subtitle of her first book is The Survival of Themes from the Ancient Royal Cult in Sectarian Judaism and Early Christianity. Barker spends much effort reconstructing a picture of the role of the monarchy and of the wisdom traditions in the rites and practices of the temple in the days of David and Solomon and Isaiah. Evidently, the king not only acted in the role of the high priest in the temple, but in that role represented the visible presence of Yahweh, the son of the Most High God, El. Central to the myths was a belief in the human manifestation of God. A human figure occupied the divine throne and came to bring judgment. The presence of the figure also brought renewed life and fertility. The human figure was probably once the king, who was also the high priest. This aspect of Israelite kingship appears in the Psalms, but not in the histories of the kings. Why? Well, the Deuteronomists had not favored the monarchy, as can be seen from their surviving writings. They said that the wickedness of the king had caused the destruction of Jerusalem. They were to reformulate Israel's religion in such a way that the monarch was no longer central to the cult. In addition, the exile of so many people to Babylon meant that they were physically separated from the temple, which had been the center of their life. These two circumstances combined to alter radically the perception of the presence of God in the temple. The events of history necessitated the idea of God not located in one holy place, but rather of God traveling with his people, and the Deuteronomists rejected all the ancient anthropomorphisms of the royal cult. Theirs was to be a God whose voice was heard and obeyed, but who had no visible form. So, like we say, we get glimpses of the old royal cult in the Psalms. And one of the puzzles of biblical scholarship has been to reconcile the picture of royalty in the Psalms with the uniformly negative picture that comes from the books of Samuel and Kings. The Deuteronomists suppressed the anthropomorphism of the older tradition, and any idea of the visible presence of God was abandoned. There were two reasons for this. They were heirs to the monotheism of the second Isaiah, who had identified El Elyon with Yahweh and therefore relocated Yahweh in heaven rather than in the temple in Jerusalem. They were constructing from the ruins of the monarchy a faith for Israel, which no longer had the king at its center and therefore no longer had his presence as a visible sign of Yahweh with his people. The old concept of a human form present in the temple was no longer tenable, and the ancient descriptions of theophanies derived from temple ceremonial were no longer acceptable. The Deuteronomists rewrote the tradition. Then Yahweh spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of the words, but saw no form. There was only a voice. Deuteronomy 4:12. With this, one should compare the contemporary Ezekiel, a temple priest who was able to describe one like a man on a fiery throne. In Ezekiel 1:26. Another significant part of the Deuteronomist reform was the promotion of Jerusalem as the only cult center, the only temple. One of Alexander Campbell's criticisms of the Book of Mormon in 1831 was that it showed Nephi building a temple in the New World. Furthermore, subsequent generations built other temples in other cities. No Jew, Campbell and others claimed, would dream of building a temple outside of Jerusalem. Well, Nibley has observed that the discoveries at Elephantina in Egypt showed that there were groups of Jews who neither believed nor acted as though Jerusalem was the only place a temple could be built. Despite the efforts of the Deuteronomists, Barker observes that 1st Enoch shows that some in Palestine preserved the older teachings that the Deuteronomist school suppressed. Barker's Liahona for reconstructing the lost traditions is the Book of Enoch, a book that originated in Jewish tradition and was used extensively by the earliest Christians, but which fell into disrepute after the 2nd century. She traces the Enoch connections through many other texts, both back in time to Isaiah and forward to the New Testament. Indeed, she argues that Enoch and Isaiah share the same temple-based mythos, quite distinct from the law-based Moses traditions. She says that those who transmitted that text kept a role for wisdom. They kept a tradition of the heavenly ascent and the vision of God. They were astronomers with a complex theology of heavenly hosts and angels. So we need to remember that not all the Jews were taken to Babylon. 2 Kings 24:15-16 lists nobility, soldiers, craftsmen, and noting the poor were left behind. Then after Zedekiah rebelled, and more were taken. And 2 Kings 25:12 describes the poor of the land being left. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah record some of the tensions between those who returned from Babylon to build a temple with financial and political backing from Cyrus. But notice that those books record the tensions from the perspective of the returnees at the expense of the people who remained behind. In Barker's view, 1st Enoch preserves the perspective of those who remained and who viewed the returning exiles as apostates. It is noteworthy for Barker that the early Christians valued and transmitted 1st Enoch. For Barker, a key issue is that the very things that the exilic scribes attempted to suppress form the crucial background for understanding Christianity. Furthermore, she observes that the suppressed ideas center on the temple. In her books, she builds a picture of the pre-exilic religion centered on the old atonement rites in the temple. She says, "Temple theology is the original context of the New Testament in as far as the hopes, beliefs, symbols, and rituals of the temple shaped the lives of those who came to be called Christians. Temple theology knew of incarnation and atonement, the sons of God, and the life of the age to come, the day of judgment, justification, salvation, the renewed covenant, and the kingdom of God. When temple theology is presented, even in its barest outline, its striking relevance to the New Testament becomes clear. The relevance to the Book of Mormon is just as clear, particularly in light of recent studies that highlight the centrality of the temple in the Book of Mormon. In The Meaning of the Atonement, Hugh Nibley writes, "The word atonement appears only once in the New Testament, but 127 times in the Old Testament. The reason for this is apparent when we note that of the 127 times, all but five were in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, where they explicitly describe the original rites of the tabernacle or temple on the Day of Atonement. Moreover, the sole appearance of the word in the New Testament is in the Epistle to the Hebrews, explaining how those very rites are to be interpreted since the coming of Christ. Atonement, including related terms, atone, atoned, atoneth, atoning, appear 39 times in the Book of Mormon. This puts the Book of Mormon in the milieu of the old Hebrew rites before the destruction of Solomon's temple. Plus, when these themes of atonement, sons of God, the age to come, and so forth appear in the Book of Mormon, they typically do so in temple contexts. Barker writes, "It is widely agreed that the three autumn festivals of the post-exilic period, New Year, Day of Atonement, and Tabernacles, were derived from an earlier royal festival held every autumn to celebrate the renewal of the year and the enthronement of the king. Nothing can be proved, but Isaiah 40-55 is thought to be based on the liturgies of this festival." So several recent studies have shown that King Benjamin's coronation discourse at the temple comprehensively combines the themes of these festivals, the autumn festivals. Plus, it should be of interest for the Isaiah problem that a text which many scholars ascribe to a second Isaiah writing during the exile is said to point back to the liturgy of a pre-exilic festival. So we'll come back to the Isaiah problem in a bit. But Barker draws an overall picture that we should find familiar. We can now add to our pattern of vision, knowledge, judgment, ascent, and angelic status several more elements. The royal figure called a son of man, the Eden temple setting with the river of life giving water, the lamp representing both the presence of God and the tree of life whose fruits made man immortal, and the clouds which took a son of man figure to heaven. This summary passage obviously deserves a close look because these themes have conspicuous counterparts in the Book of Mormon. Vision. Vision is the notion that human beings can see God. Barker contrasts the attitudes of those who accepted the notion of throne theophanies of an anthropomorphic God, such as in Isaiah 6 and Moses' face-to-face visions, with those Deuteronomic editors who insisted that such things were impossible and had not even been. She cites the contradictory attitudes apparent in the Bible as we have it. This can be demonstrated most easily by comparing Exodus 24:10 and Deuteronomy 4:12. The Exodus text describes the events on Mount Sinai. The elders saw the God of Israel on his throne, presumably in vision. This is a vision of God exactly like that seen by Isaiah, Ezekiel, and John. The Deuteronomy text wants none of this and emphasizes that there was only a voice at Sinai. The presence of the Lord was not a vision to inspire them, but a voice giving commands that had to be obeyed. The tension between the word and vision was also a tension between the law-based religion and the temple-based religion. It can be traced all through the Bible. The Book of Mormon directly affirms the reality and importance of vision, starting with Lehi's vision of the throne of God and the one descending out of heaven, and others like stars following him. This corresponds extraordinarily well to Barker's picture. Lehi's and Nephi's subsequent visions of the Tree of Life add more correlation, and this continues with Alma, Lamoni, his queen, the servant Abish, the mixed multitude of Lehites who experienced the visit of the risen Lord, and later Mormon and Moroni. Visions come to men and women, office holders and laypersons, believers and at times unbelievers. But the correlation between Barker's picture and the Book of Mormon goes beyond the belief in visions to include a constellation of interrelated notions. Knowledge. Is knowledge good or evil? This next quote is just so amazingly delicious to read from a Protestant writer. Barker writes, "Now wisdom in the Old Testament was regarded in two very different ways. The Reformers were suspicious of wisdom, but the older religion of Israel seems to have recognized that wisdom, that is the Spirit, transformed human beings and made them like God. Paul said the same thing in Romans 8:14-17. If the Spirit of God dwells in you, you are the sons of God. The serpent in Eden was right. Knowledge, that is wisdom, did make human beings godlike. The problem was it a good thing for human beings to be godlike, to be the sons of God? Those who reformed Israel's religion set themselves against all these ideas, and that is the real root of the difference between Christianity and Judaism. The Christians were not afraid to describe themselves as sons of God." Times change. The attitude of Book of Mormon is explicit in the covenant discourse in Mosiah, verses 5-7. "Ye are born of him and have become his sons and daughters." The doctrine also appears in the statements of the Lord in 3 Nephi 9:17, preparatory to his visit to the temple in Bountiful. "As many as have received me, to them have I been given to become the sons of God." Not only is the doctrine appropriate, but so is the covenantal temple context in which these teachings are given. With respect to knowledge, the Lord's teaching in the Book of Mormon includes admonitions to study, that the multitude prepare their minds. That's 3 Nephi 17:3. The sons of Mosiah are particularly good examples in Alma 17, verses 2 and 3. Alma did rejoice exceedingly to see his brethren, and what added more to his joy, they were still his brethren in the Lord. Yea, and they had waxed strong in the knowledge of the truth, for they were men of a sound understanding, and they had searched the scriptures diligently that they might know the word of God. But this is not all. They had given themselves to much prayer and fasting. Therefore they had the spirit of prophecy and the spirit of revelation. And when they taught with power and authority of God. Several places in the Book of Mormon include examples of the genre of wisdom literature. Nibley cites Helaman 12 as an example of wisdom. Daniel Peterson's essay, Nephi and His Yeshira, makes numerous connections between the Book of Mormon and wisdom literature, particularly, but not exclusively, in comparing Proverbs 1-9 with the vision of the Tree of Life. Of the ancient wisdom, Barker writes, wisdom was a body of knowledge and practices which gave power over creation when used in conjunction with supernatural forces. It was the essence of all that had been corrupted through pride and rebellion. Likewise, the Book of Mormon contains conspicuous cautions about pride. And specifically, Nephi's brother Jacob says regarding knowledge, to be learned is good if they hearken to the counsels of God. Not only is Jacob's sentiment here consistent with the angel mythology of Enoch, in which the fallen angels are those who pervert knowledge, but the whole passage is permeated with imagery, language, and divine titles from the mythos that Barker describes. Back to another Barker quote. One of the problems faced by New Testament scholars is how wisdom and preexistence can relate to the idea of the virgin birth. But read in light of the Enoch wisdom, this is no problem at all. The birth of a son of God would have marked the beginning of a new era when the old decay and corruption were reversed and wisdom in an uncorrupted form brought into creation. Thus, sonship and obedience belong naturally together, since the agents of the first corruption were rebel sons of God. The evil spirits which they left to torment the earth were those Jesus encountered in the miracles, who feared that they were being destroyed before the time. It is these demons who recognized Jesus as the Son of God, and they knew how this affected them. Barker writes, the question we cannot answer is, how is it that Jubilees and Job have an account of the creation that includes the angels, which Genesis does not mention, even though it does have an evil serpent figure, of whose origin we are told nothing? Later traditions knew that an elaborate heavenly world had been created before the material world, and this heaven was totally integrated with the earth. So accordingly, the Book of Mormon includes information about the fallen angels and their role that is missing from the Genesis creation account. And our Book of Moses and the Book of Abraham contain information about the spirit creation preceding the physical creation. These things are implicit in Alma 13. Now, I've been impressed by Robert Alter's suggestions about the use of type scenes in the Bible. So I recently decided that the story of the wicked priests of Noah, Amulon, and his crew, they might be emphasized in the Book of Mosiah partially because Amulon's priests are types of the fallen angels. In the Enoch stories, that is, they pervert sacred knowledge for gain, they take wives they shouldn't have taken, and finally their descendants meet with destruction. Jacob's caution against the abuse of knowledge comes with an endorsement of the value of gaining knowledge. The Book of Mormon writers constantly endorse the seeking and applying of wisdom. And the best quote on that is Mosiah 8:20. Oh, how marvelous are the works of the Lord, and how long doth he suffer with his people. Yea, and how blind and impenetrable are the understandings of the children of men. For they will not seek wisdom, neither do they desire that she should rule over them. Notice, too, that the Book of Mormon also retains the feminine aspect of the ancient wisdom traditions and sides with those who would embrace wisdom. Judgment. Barker emphasizes that an important part of the angel mythology and the atonement rites was the idea of judgment. The major theme of the Son of Man texts is judgment. If we look at other references, if we look at other references to judgment in the biblical texts, we find the recurring theme of a great harvest. We cannot say that one judgment passage has been copied from another because there are so many aspects of harvest represented. We can only conclude that the whole theme of harvest was associated with judgment. The great harvest festival of Israel, the Feast of Sukkoth, also called booths, tabernacles, and tents, was celebrated by building leafy shelters and carrying branches in a great procession. The second stage of this reconstruction shows how the harvest judgment was associated with the royal figure and his ascending the throne. So again, the theme of judgment occurs in the Book of Mormon in exactly the right context. Whether the judgments that Lehi reads from a book in his testamentary vision, or the subsequent vision of the fall of the pride of the world, or in King Benjamin's discourse. Consider the elaborate parable of the wild and tame olive trees leading up to a final harvest and judgment. Consider again Benjamin's coronation at the temple in conjunction with the Feast of the Tabernacles. Plus, 3 Nephi 8-29 includes judgment themes as part of the Messiah's role. There's another passage I could read there, but I'd better not. Barker adds some additional aspects of the judgment that illuminate the Book of Mormon. She says, the Enoch tradition, however, has a distinctive attitude toward fertility, which could throw light on the situation at the time of the monarchy. Fertility followed the destruction of the evil angels and established the rule of the Great Holy One. Perverted knowledge was removed from the earth. The pattern was judgment, true knowledge, and fertility. It derived, I believe, from the sequence of the autumn festival, where the renewal of fertility was bound up with the renewal of kingship after the enactment of the great judgment, which gave rise to the biblical imagery of judgment as harvest. In every case where Isaiah mentions fertility, it is in such a context of judgment. There are significant word patterns in Isaiah 35:5-6. The deaf, the blind, the lame, and the dumb are healed in the renewal of creation. But the names are also the names of four types of angel. How these supernatural beings were connected to these disabilities is not clear, but it is surely no coincidence that Jesus used the curing of these four types as a sign. John the Baptist asked if Jesus was the one expected in Luke 7:20. And the reply was an amalgam of these verses in Isaiah 61:1. In the Gospels, the defeat of these creatures, of what these creatures represented, is seen as a sign of the kingdom of God. So Barker's point is that there was a specific expectation that the Messiah should demonstrate his power over these specific manifestations of evil. John's disciples asked, Art thou he that should come, or look we for another? By way of response, Luke says that, and in that same hour he cured many of their infirmities and plagues, and of evil spirits, and unto many that were blind he gave sight. Then after performing these particular miracles, Jesus said unto them, go your way and tell John what things ye have seen and heard. How the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, to the poor the gospel is preached. The answer through action shows rather than tells, and therefore makes sense only in light of her pre-existing expectation. Notice how appropriate, then, that in the Book of Mormon, not only does Benjamin prophesy these cures as signs of the Messiah, and does so in the proper temple context during the autumn festival. In Mosiah chapter 3 and 2 and 4 to 7. And the things which I shall tell you are made known unto me by an angel from God. And he said unto me, awake, and I awoke. And behold, he stood before me. And he said unto me, awake, and hear the words which I shall tell thee. For behold, I am come to declare unto you the glad tidings of great joy. For behold, the time cometh, and is not far distant, that with power the Lord Omnipotent, who reigneth, who was, and is from all eternity to all eternity, shall come down from heaven among the children of men, and shall dwell in a tabernacle of clay, and shall go forth amongst men, working mighty miracles, such as healing the sick, raising the dead, causing the lame to walk, the blind to receive their sight, the deaf to hear, and curing all manner of diseases. And he shall cast out devils, or the evil spirits which shall dwell in the hearts of the children of men. And lo, he shall suffer temptations and pain of body, hunger and thirst and fatigue, even more than man can suffer, except it be unto death. For behold, blood cometh from every pore, so great shall be his anguish, for the wickedness and the abominations of his people. And he shall rise the third day from the dead, and behold, he standeth to judge the world. And behold, these things are done that a righteous judgment might come upon the children of men. For behold, and also his blood atoneth for the sins of those who have fallen by the transgression of Adam, who have died not knowing the will of God, or who have ignorantly sinned. In fulfillment of this prophecy, 3 Nephi 26:15 duly notes these specific signs of the Messiah. 3 Nephi 26:15. And it came to pass that after he had ascended into heaven, the second time he had showed himself unto them, and he had gone unto the Father, having healed all their sick and their lame, and opened the eyes of the blind, and unstopped the ears of the deaf, and even had done all manner of cures among them, and raised a man from the dead, and had shown forth his power unto them, and had ascended unto the Father. Ascent. Barker claims that the throne theophanies, such as Isaiah 6, were standard in pre-exilic Israel. She cites evidence that the kings of Israel, as well as the prophets, participated in the heavenly ascent. Further, she shows the imagery of the ascent was used by Enoch and Ezekiel and others, was conditioned by temple practices and symbols. Accordingly, Lehi's vision in 1 Nephi 1 turns out to be a perfect example of a throne theophany. Nephi 2 claims this kind of experience in 2 Nephi 4, 23 and 25. "Behold, he hath heard my cry by day, and hath given me knowledge by visions in the nighttime. And by day have I waxed bold in mighty prayer before him. Yea, my voice have I sent up on high, and angels came down and ministered unto me. And upon the wings of his spirit hath my body been carried away upon to exceeding high mountains. And mine eyes have beheld great things, yea, even too great for man. Therefore I was bidden that I should not write them." In his classic essay, The Meaning of the Atonement, Hugh Nibley has shown that Nephi's psalm here is ripe with atonement imagery, which ties it closer to the temple. 3 Nephi 11 to 29 also places ascent in a temple context, with a multitude beginning in the darkness of the destruction and recreation, which is what it is, encountering the messenger at the temple, who provides instructions and covenants through which some pass through a veiling cloud and return to the presence of the Father. And we have a similar thing going on with the brother of Jared at the veil. But we'll come back to Benjamin. Remember that King Benjamin's assertion that the words of his discourse were provided by an angel, and with the implication that Benjamin too had experienced the ascent prior to taking his throne and acting as the high priest during the atonement rites. We'll come back to Benjamin. Angelic status. Angels permeate the Book of Mormon. The word angel appears 85 times in the text. We find that acquiring an angel status, that is, eternal life, is symbolized by putting on white garments and sometimes by anointing with oil, thus linking the angels to the royal figure. The righteous, says Enoch, will wear garments of glory. Now remember the passage describing the transformation of the three Nephites in 3 Nephi 28:6-17. This passage combines ascent and angelic status. Notice, too, that the Book of Mormon frequently discusses white garments in connection with atonement and judgment. For example, 1 Nephi 12:10-11. "And these 12 ministers whom thou beholdest shall judge thy seed, and behold, they are righteous forever. For behold, because of their faith in the Lamb of God, their garments are made white in his blood. And the angel said unto me, Look, and I looked, and beheld three generations pass away in righteousness, and their garments were white, even like unto the Lamb of God. And the angel said unto me, These are made white in the blood of the Lamb, because of their faith in him." And there's similar passages in Alma 13 and 3 Nephi 19:25, which I'll let go this time. The royal figure called the Son of Man. "For Barker, the Son of Man," sings from the Book of Enoch, "illuminate the ways Jesus used the title in reference to himself. Except in a quote from Isaiah, the phrase does not appear in the Book of Mormon and does not seem to be a title there. However, the title does appear several times in the Enoch passages of our Book of Moses." Nibley writes that in the Old Testament, the expression Son of Man is found only in four poetic passages in which it is hardly more than an expression for an ordinary human. In the New Testament, it is not, as anyone would naturally expect, the unassuming title of one who would depict himself humbly as a common mortal, delicately and modestly, or even in self-depreciation. For in all the occurrences of the title in the New Testament, it refers to the Lord in his capacity as the exalted one from on high, whose real nature and glory are hidden from men. Aside from these occurrences, the title Son of Man is never used as a title in the intertestamental literature except in the Similitudes of Enoch, which is in the Book of Enoch, the same one that Barker follows. Here is a very neat test for Joseph Smith. The Son of Man title does not occur once in the Book of Mormon either, and in the Pearl of Great Price it is confined to one brief section of the Book of Mormon, where it is used no fewer than 7 times. Again, the prophet is right on target. It's also used in the Book of Abraham, I noticed, in the pre-existent vision, one likened to the Son of Man coming forth. But it's there, too. It's in exactly the right context in the temple situation. The Book of Mormon does show the Nephite kings and even some of the Lamanite kings enacting the appropriate messianic roles, including Benjamin's apparent acting as the high priest during the atonement rites, and King Lamoni prefiguring the death and ascent of the Messiah. And actually, the timing of Lamoni's vision, it was during the festival, because you recall the story was Lamoni's father is mad at him because Lamoni was supposed to come to the festival. Everyone is supposed to come. And Lamoni didn't show up. Well, why didn't Lamoni show up? Well, because he was actually having the experience that the temple rite would just be acting out. That just occurred to me now. That's pretty cool. The Eden Temple setting with a river of life-giving water and a tree of life. Barker writes that in the traditions of the ancient Near East, there is a garden of paradise where a gardener supervises the tree of life growing at the water of life. The Testament of Judah describes the Messiah as this branch of the God Most High and his fountain giving life unto all. Note that the royal figure is both tree and fountain. Accordingly, in the Book of Mormon, in answer to a question about the meaning of the tree of life in 1 Nephi 11:1-11, Nephi is granted a vision of the Lamb of God, yea, even the Son of the Eternal Father. After viewing this, Nephi realizes that the tree represents the love of God along with the fountain of living waters, or the tree of life, which waters are a representation of the love of God. Barker also observed several contrasts between the Mountain Eden of Ezekiel, which derives from the imagery of the first temple, with the Eden Genesis, with the Eden of Genesis, as the Bible shows it. She also writes critically of the Bible garden story as an explanation of evil that asserts that human disobedience is the cause of evil. She not only sees unanswered questions in the Bible story, such as its failure to explain the presence of the serpent, but serious problems for Christianity in its adoption. Quote, how many people who come apart and need expert help are victims of their own religious system, destroyed by feelings of guilt, inadequacy, and dependence, which have been implanted by a religious upbringing. In women, this is particularly so, as their status in society has been determined by the Christian view of their proper role. In contrast, she cites the story told in the Enoch books about the rebel angels and the fall from heaven as not only a theologically stronger account, but also that the New Testament seems to assume the influence of the fallen angels. She believes that the fallen angel story has only the remotest link to the Adam and Eve story. Now, however, the Book of Mormon quite nicely weaves the fallen angel stories together with a variant Adam and Eve story, one which has a much stronger theodicy and a much more optimistic view of the potential of humankind in general, and women in particular, than the traditional Genesis account. Clouds and ascent to heaven. Barker writes that it makes a great deal of difference to our picture of the Messiah in the New Testament if the name had formerly meant the anointed one who enjoyed the presence of God and had the status of an angel. And the pattern beginning to emerge, the vision of God was linked to judgment, to ascent, and to angelic status, and all of these were linked to the anointed one. All these come through as a pattern in early Christian thought. The ascent visions were associated with the temple and its rituals. We have already noted that the ascent appears in several places in the Book of Mormon, including the temple experience with the risen Lord in 3 Nephi 18. And I'll just read it. It says, and now I go unto the Father, because it is expedient that I should go unto the Father for your sakes. And it came to pass, when Jesus had touched them all, there came a cloud and overshadowed the multitude, that they could not see Jesus. And while they were overshadowed, he departed from them and ascended into heaven. And the disciples saw and did bear record that he ascended again into heaven. Implications and open questions. It happens that much in Barker's work contradicts the pet assumptions and claims of various critical scholars regarding the nature of pre-exilic Judaism, and consequently undermines their perception of conflicts with the picture in the Book of Mormon. If Barker is correct, how did a youthful Joseph Smith manage to produce so much of the same picture? Certain of her interpretations clash with usual LDS readings, to be sure, notably her acceptance on the dating of Isaiah 40-54 to a second Isaiah writing during the Babylonian exile. But a number of relevant studies on the so-called Isaiah problem in the Book of Mormon often anticipate points of tension. And since Camorra, Nibley pointed out some ways that we can reconcile the Isaiah quotations with multiple authorship theories. He noted that the Book of Mormon does not quote any passages ascribed to the third Isaiah, nor does it quote Isaiah 1, a chapter that many scholars think was written as a late summary of the book. On the other hand, you have Abraham Gileadi and others who have made some potent arguments for the unity of Isaiah. So I don't think we're stuck in an all-or-nothing situation. We can concentrate on the points of interest in the big picture, and I'm finding even this apparent point of conflict has some tantalizing aspects despite some tensions. She makes a key claim that ideas like strict monotheism were first asserted during the Babylonian exile by the second Isaiah. However, the authorship Isaiah and text transmission issue eventually resolves, most of the specific Isaiah passages and chapters that Barker cites to demonstrate the strict monotheism of the second Isaiah do not appear in the Book of Mormon. And it's her thought that it was this writer during the exile who invented monotheism. than it happened later. And in a minute, we're going to see her description of how that happened. She says the prophecies of the second Isaiah were, I believe, an interpretation of an ancient cult myth, and it was the experience of the exile which prompted the reinterpretation in terms of actual historical events. The conventional scholarly dating of Isaiah 40 to 55 to the exile is based on such things as the assumption that there is no real prophecy, that the name of Cyrus appears in chapter 45, and there are themes and concerns in the text that point to this situation of the exile. Barker's line of interpretation here is fresh and fascinating. Now I'm going to be reading from the Older Testament here. The message of the prophet was that the divine word, as depicted in the myths and rituals of the older cult, had been fulfilled in history. The first Isaiah had interpreted the events of his own time in terms of that myth. The second Isaiah completed this interpretation by showing that the lesser deities, the sons of the gods, and all that they represented really had. They had ceased to exist. The final defeat of the old gods, however, left several aspects of the original scheme adrift. The defeated beings had formerly borne the burden for the origin of evil, a necessary function in any theological scheme. They had been the opposing forces in the struggle to establish order in the creation. Barker sees a distinct pattern of association running through the verses in Isaiah chapters 41 through 48. Isaiah 41 to 21 introduces the former things. Isaiah 42, 8 to 9 says that the former things never happened. 43:9 challenges other nations to demonstrate their power by showing the former things and bringing their witnesses. The powerlessness of these witnesses is part of a complex declaration of monotheism. 44:6 to 8 and 45:20 and 21 have the theme of the former things, but not the phrase. Both emphasize that the power to know the future is proof of divinity. 46:8-10 demands that the transgressors remember the former things. 48:3-5 says that the former things were declared by Yahweh long ago and have happened. The climax of the two passages, Isaiah 43:13 and 46:9, and the emphasis elsewhere at Isaiah 40:18 and 45:14, shows the other great shift which formed the theology of the second Isaiah was that Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, was also El. Israel was no longer at the mercy of contending angelic forces, of which Yahweh was but one. If Yahweh was El, the others were nothing. In contrast to these passages, we find one other, Isaiah 43:16-19, which follows upon the court scene where the gods are declared to be nothing. Here, and only here, the prophet exhorts to forget the former things, and a whole new understanding of Yahweh is outlined. For me, a most intriguing aspect of Barker's line of argument here is that only one passage from Isaiah 48 about the fulfillment of prophecy appears in the Book of Mormon. None of the rest of the argument appears, and that passage by itself does not sustain it. That said, I should point out that a few of her examples that suggest exilic editing in Isaiah do appear in the Book of Mormon. Yahweh, your maker, who stretched out the heaven and laid the foundations of the earth, in Isaiah 51:13 is also Jacob 8:13. However, she sees this as an example of an application of an ancient El title as the progenitor of the earth into a fusion transformation with Yahweh taking the creative role, becoming a maker rather than a progenitor. Yet in this case, I think there is no real cause for concern. In our theology, Yahweh is the creator rather than the progenitor. And this could be an instance where the translation is sufficient to suit my purposes as it stands, as Joseph says in DNC 128:18. Another exception is when she asks, how does... Second Isaiah's Abraham, in Isaiah 52:2, who symbolizes the exiles, relate to the Abraham of Genesis, who carries the royal promises, and the patriarch, who does not recognize the indigenous Yahweh worshippers in Isaiah 63:16. So she's contrasting three different perspectives on Abraham. But the Isaiah 52:2 is part of the Isaiah quotation in 2 Nephi 8, which has an interesting context. In this recent book from Farms, the Isaiah in the Book of Mormon, John Thompson has an article called Isaiah 50-51, the Israelite Autumn Festivals and the Covenant Speech of Jacob in 2 Nephi 6-10. He writes that, from the structure and themes of 2 Nephi 6-10, one may conclude that Jacob's speech was given in connection with the covenant renewal celebration that was most likely performed as part of the national Israelite Autumn Festivals required by the law of Moses. Recent studies like this one make it plain that it's not just a matter of Isaiah scholarship raising issues for the Book of Mormon, but that the Book of Mormon should be recognized as raising issues for scholarship. Remember that Barker cites authorities that believe that these Isaiah passages were based on the liturgy of a pre-exilic festival, and the Book of Mormon quotes them in that context. Why should that be so if the passages were entirely exilic? The story of Abinadi in Mosiah 11 to 17 contains a quotation of Isaiah 53 and a discourse that shows an understanding of Isaiah 52. Of this passage, a trio of Farms researchers concluded, no other day on the Israelite calendar fits the message, words, and experience of the prophet Abinadi more precisely than does the ancient Israelite festival of Pentecost. During the post-resurrection ministry in 3rd Nephi, Jesus quotes Isaiah 54. John Welch points out that since Jesus was there to quote them, the chapter might not have been on the brass plates that Nephi obtained from Laban in Jerusalem. The quotation of Isaiah 48 and 49 seems to resonate deeply with the experience of Nephi in the Arabian desert. There's a study by, Eskent Brown has an article called What is Isaiah Doing in 1st Nephi? That's pretty interesting on that. And it's also apt because no chapters in all scripture teach this faith and hope in Isaiah's future redemption better than Isaiah 48 and 49. Similarly, no chapters more forcefully address Israel's rebellious hypocrites than do Isaiah 48 and 49. That's a conclusion from Andrew Skinner, another article in Isaiah in the Book of Mormon. So the Book of Mormon is not adverse to other versions of scriptural books around and assumes that the existing books might have been edited. And what exactly are the parameters of an inspired translation? No one knows. If the Isaiah issue cannot be said to be decisively resolved, there is, as Thomas Kuhn observes, something to be said for tolerating crisis. Like artists, creative scientists, and I presume to add scholars and laypersons, must be able to live in a world out of joint. Kuhn describes this situation as an essential tension. Despite the current irresolution of the Isaiah situation, the Book of Mormon use of Isaiah has been tantalizingly fruitful and remains, in my view, very promising. I think Barker's views can be reconciled with our text. The Risen Lord and D&C 93. Exploring the whole body of work that Barker has produced promises to take a considerable effort, but for now I want to move directly to the major assertion that she makes in The Risen Lord, the Jesus of History as the Christ of Faith, which is a book she had out just a couple of years ago. The foreground assertion in The Risen Lord is that Jesus had an ascent experience at his baptism that, against the conceptual background of the First Temple, served to provide his self-understanding. All the Gospels agree that the baptism of Jesus marked the beginning of his ministry. I want to explore the possibility that for Jesus, this was the moment at which he became the Son of God. His baptism was a Merkava ascent experience when he believed he had become the heavenly high priest, the Lord with his people. Notice that her emphasis in The Risen Lord is on what the notion of a baptismal ascent experience does to illuminate Jesus' life and ministry. However radical her claim might seem, we, of all Christians, should be keenly interested in her ideas because of Doctrine and Covenants 93:11-19. A revelation that Joseph Smith received and wrote on May 6, 1833 in Kirtland, Ohio. And I, John, bear record that I beheld his glory as the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth, even the Spirit of truth which came and dwelt in the flesh and dwelt among us. And I, John, saw that he received not of the fullness at first, but received grace for grace. And he received not of the fullness at first, but continued from grace to grace until he received a fullness. Thus he was called the Son of God, because he received not of the fullness at first. And I, John, bear record, and lo, the heavens were opened, and the Holy Ghost descended upon him in the form of a dove, and sat upon him. And there came a voice out of heaven, saying, This is my beloved Son. And I, John, bear record that he received the fullness of the glory of the Father, and he received all power, both in heaven and on earth. And the glory of the Father was with him, for he dwelt in him. And it shall come to pass that if you are faithful, you shall receive the fullness of the record of John. And I give unto you these sayings that ye may understand and know how to worship and know what you worship, that you may come unto the Father in my name and in due time receive of his fullness. Joseph Smith provided no commentary on what prompted this revelation. We frequently quote passages from D&C 93 for key statements on truth, faith, pre-existing intelligences, epistemology, ontology, and on the responsibility of parents to raise up their children in light and truth. However, we have done little with the idea that Jesus received the fullness of the glory of the Father at the time of his baptism. Barker's The Risen Lord provides a significant commentary on and contextualization of just these ideas. The impressive research into primary materials is so well grounded that if we want to discuss these D&C passages at all, it behooves us to take a serious and respectful look at what she has to say. For example, she describes this ascension experience as a Merkabah mystic experience. Merkabah is just a Hebrew word for chariot, the idea that you would ascend to the throne, and the word, it's in the book of Ezekiel when he rides the chariot up to the throne of the Father. So there's this whole tradition of Hebrew mysticism based on the notion of the ascent via the chariot. Okay. An impressive number of other texts that she uses to contextualize the claim that Jesus had a profound revelatory experience at his baptism should already be familiar territory to informed Mormons. Am I running out of time here? My goodness. Okay, well, let me just... Okay. Time flies when you're learning. Okay. I'll read one more quote here and skip a few things and... Her direct argument in The Risen Lord is largely with scholars who prefer to imagine that Christianity as such originated in the despair of the apostles in trying to come to terms with the unexpected death of Jesus. The paradigm that I am proposing answers several questions. It shows the link between Christology and soteriology, which just means salvation, in the roots of first century Palestine, interpreting what is there in the resources available within the resources of available tradition. The paradigm I am proposing also shows that what Jesus believed about himself was identical with what the young church preached about it, even though he had been imperfectly understood at times. It makes Jesus himself the author and finisher of the faith rather than the early communities, a supposition which has been fashionable for some time. So the message of the atonement was not just a damage limitation exercise on the part of a traumatized group of disciples who could find no other way of coming to terms with the death of their leader. Let's see. And she also says that, I'll have to leave all this out. Well, there's more. For those who are still intrigued, I sent a copy of this to William Hamlin at Farms, and within 48 hours, he sent back a note that said, "This is great, can I publish it?" And I said I wanted to work on it some more, and he said he had some suggestions. And I get to teach a Institute class at KU, and they asked, I said, "What do you want me to teach? You want to teach?" And I said, "I want to work on Barker in the Book of Mormon." And they said, "Okay." So I basically get to do whatever I want. There's one thing that I really should say that I think is very cool. It'd be cool to close on. Where in the traditions available to the original disciples in Palestine do we find a belief or hope that a divine being or even the Lord himself who was the atonement sacrifice? The priestly laws of the Old Testament are both complex and obscure on the matter of the atonement, and the details about lambs and goats are clear enough, but the theology which describes the rituals expressed is still largely unknown. This must be a major obstacle in any attempt to understand Christian origins, because it is a very big step indeed from goats and lambs in the temple to the human sacrifice of one declared to be the Lord, the Son of God. This step is unacknowledged in any account I have read of atonement in the New Testament. So as a last thought, notice that in the Book of Mormon discusses exactly those things in explaining the atonement. It was providing something that you can't get anywhere else. And it fits in so nicely with what she's done. I'm amazed. I've actually written to her, and she's got a copy of this. I'm interested to see what she thinks of it. But thank you for coming. I'm just thrilled to be able to have discovered this, and I'm eager to share it, which is, why I drive for 10 hours and pay $50 to come and read a paper to a few people. But it's thrilling. And it's a testimony. It's increased my testimony. Just when I was going through toward the end of writing this paper, and that last quote from Barker about bridging the gap between the sacrifice of animals and the sacrifice of a god, I went through the Book of Mormon and just put it in my lap, and I went through and I turned from passage to passage just to get my references. And as I just scanned them all quickly, I had another witness to myself of what a remarkable thing we have. It's just an astonishing book. And reading her books has transformed my reading of the Book of Mormon, so that now every page starts to jump out at me in ways it never did before. And thank you for coming. And if you want to read the whole paper, I'll give you my email and I can send you a copy. Or if you want to, KSKChris, yeah, @sunflower.com. The format is in Word. If you don't have that format, tell me what format you want, and I'll save it out as that before I send it to you. And if you want to, you know, I have no idea. You know, I can't. There wasn't anyone.
It is.
Okay. Yeah, we'll find out. So, but this, it is going to be in print, and if you want to participate and critique it, because I don't want to send it out quite yet, because there's much more. It's just, you know, these seven books, and she has this incredible set of seven books. And there's a bibliography of her books. Most of them are out of print at the moment. You can find them via the web. This one may be the one to start with, The Great Angel. It's not her first one, but her first one is out of print. But I don't know if I should say this, but I think I will. William Hamlin told me that they're thinking about asking her if they can republish her books. You know, and this would be very cool. The one in England. It's a number of different publishers. The best way to find them is just go to a place like http www.bookfinder.com and do a search on Barker or Barnes & Noble, just one of the websites, and do a search for Margaret Barker and see which books come up. And that's how I got most of the ones I've got. The BYU Library does have several of these books. They do have the Older Testament, which is the foundation on which everything else is built on. That's been out of print for years, and you cannot get it because I tried, although I did Xerox it, which made it easier. But I'm way over time, so thank you for coming and showing interest.